Good morning, members. Call the meeting to order, and we are going to continue through DNR, and we're almost finished all of our overviews and ready to budget. But this is welcome again. Today, Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Today we begin a new era, kind of, in my opinion, in budget presentations and discussing numbers from the agency with the legislature. The spreadsheet you have before you is, I term it a work of art that has taken us a long time to get this far, but really what it is, it's a performance management system that connects our strategic goals to our budget, and it allows us to use indicators and conservation targets to measure results. It's nowhere near perfect, but I want to walk through this with you in presenting our 10-11 budget. Your input is needed and desired as to how we can fine-tune this tool, because it is one that we do intend on using into the future as well. So with that, you have a spreadsheet that has different colors on it. The change items that are in the budget are highlighted in yellow. So we'll be focusing on the change items. What we do, and it's the structure is similar for each division, but on the top you can see we have strategic objectives, which is what we discussed in our 2008-2009 overviews. Then the next column is the estimated percent of the coming fiscal year 10-11 division budgeted expenditures, and this is an estimated number. And if you just look at that first column, we've broken it down by an estimated percentage of that total, and then we also estimate what the general fund expenditure may be based upon 08-09 dollars. Our spending plans are really developed after the legislature passes its budget, so once we receive a budget that's signed into law, we sit down at the division level, at the department level, and develop a spending plan that reflects those dollars that were actually passed. That spending plan looks at all sources of revenue: general fund, special revenue, natural resources fund, the funds that we've spent a lot of time talking about. So to get to that level at this stage of the game for 10 and 11 just isn't doable for us. We put together our best guesses on this. Then we talk about the supporting programs, which we spent a lot of time about. The change items, as I mentioned, are in yellow. And then we give an example indicators for those change item targets. And then we talk about the outcomes for next biennium 10-11 that are, again, these are preliminary, but these are our goals and our targets, what we're aiming to do in the next biennium. As we come to the end, if you look a year ahead from now, this column would be moved over one. We would put in new indicators. We would talk about if we've met these indicators or not. So this is kind of the way we're thinking about doing and presenting our budgets now and into the future, and I hope that it meets your expectations. With that, we're going to spend a lot of time just focusing on the spreadsheet and the fact sheets that I've distributed. I'm not planning on going into the budget book in detail. If people have questions about what's in the budget book, you can let me know and we can meet after committee or set up some other time, or we can go through your questions however you want to deal with them. But I thought it'd be best spent, our time would be best spent talking about the change items, the actual spreadsheets, the projections we're talking about, and the programs that we've outlined within our fact sheets. With that, I have Director Vadas with us from our Lands and Minerals Division. We're going to talk about Lands and Minerals first, then do Fish and Wildlife and Forestry today, and then we'll pick up again next Tuesday, I believe. If you look at the spreadsheet on page 1 for Lands and Minerals, the estimated budget and expenditures for fiscal year 10 and 11, and we've subtracted TILT at this point in time, but I do have TILT in this column on the far right. These are the actual operating budget dollars. It's estimated to be about $20,796,000. This doesn't include $2 million in special revenue, because those dollars would come in as those fees for services or those activities take place. So these are the dollars that are actually represented for the operating budget. You can see on the far right of this top line here, the governor's recommendations for the total division with TILT is $57,384,000. And TILT is about $35 million. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Director Vadas to talk about the four strategic objectives and then the outcomes and the change items.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Marty Vadas. I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division. and focusing on the spreadsheet, as you can see, our budget in lands and minerals is broken down into four areas, and two of them are change items, so I'll quickly go through this, but focus on the change items to try to answer any questions you might have. The first one is mineral management, and this is the portion of the budget to manage the state's 12 million acres of mineral rights, and the kinds of activities are mineral title research and mineral leasing, and collecting the revenues off of those lands. And in fiscal year 2008, that was $31 million of income. In calendar year 2008, that was about $37 million of income. It's been very active in the minerals area this past year. And for example, in 2008, 72 miles of bedrock drill core were drilled in our state from this mineral activity. And so you may recall that for this current biennium, this mineral management account is funded principally through a portion of the mineral revenue, the mineral income. And if there are no questions on that, I'll move on then to the next item, which is mine land reclamation. And this is an area where there is a change item that's being proposed. And you may recall that last budget session there was discussion over recovering costs of mine land reclamation and administering the permits mined for taconite operations. And in the budget that we're currently operating on then, there was a $200,000 fee that was assessed to the different taconite companies for that purpose. And in the legislation from last time, there was direction for DNR to come back with a report that lists the full cost of issuing permits, not only for taconite, but for non-ferrous and for peat as well, and also a plan on recovering those costs. And so we did that. We put that report together and delivered that to the chairs January 15th. And what the report says in short is that the whole cost of this program is about $1.4 million a year. And we listed five options for recovering the cost of those fees. And so these would be for, again, taconite, non-ferrous, and for peat. And the five options we listed are remain in general funds. The program's been funded by the general fund since the 1970s. Another option was to continue on with the $200,000 fee for taconite. Third option was to fully recover the cost through a fee to the taconite operators and peat operators. Fourth option was to recover a fee from the mineral fee owners, those individuals and entities that receive royalty payment for taconite that's mined in the state. And fifth option was to recover the cost of new or amended permits. We are seeing a tremendous amount of activity in the state with new proposed mineral developments, Esther Steel, Mesabi Nugget, Polymet, and they're spending a considerable amount of time on that. So another option was to do like you do with environmental review and recover the cost of working on those permits. And so this report didn't make any particular recommendation on which of those options to select, but there is this fact sheet, and in the governor's budget there is a recommendation, and I'll refer to that. It's a combination of the things that we had in the report. The first is that there would be an annual permit fee charged to mining companies, and there's a fee schedule listed here for taconite and for peat operators, and also should there be non-ferrous operators. There's a fee for application for new permits or amended permits. And that would contain a provision that also the applicant would pay any sort of cost for reviewing an application for and issuing an application for a permit to mine. And also it contains the recommendation that there be a reclamation fee added to fee owners. And that in this fact sheet is 3/4 of 1 cent per ton of taconite mined. And in combination, under kind of current level of activity that would fund that, that fully fund that reclamation activity. So the change item then is to reduce the general fund by $2.404 million for the biennium and replace that general fund with a new fee that would be assessed as I described. The next item then on the spreadsheet is real estate management, and there's another change item here. This is the activity the department does on managing the state lands, doing things like land sales, land exchanges, land survey. We issue easements and licenses and leases and easements, and that kind of activity, like any major landowner would do. And the change item in this real estate management account would be a reduction of $675,000 per year in the general fund. That would be $1.35 million for the biennium. And the proposal would be that a portion of that would be replaced by charging the full cost of issuing two kinds of land transactions. The first would be utility licenses. These are when either major utility companies or individuals request to easements across state land for the purpose of power or, in the case of utilities, some very large pipelines that are going across the state. And the proposal would be for water crossings, and we do about 200 of those per year. The fee for those currently is $500 per application, and that would go to $2,000 per application. For land crossings, there are about 35 of those a year. The fee would go from $500 to $5,000. And another class of transactions that we do are road easements, and this is where whatever entity, an individual or a unit of government, request an easement to cross DNR administered land. The cost for issuing or for the application for an easement would go from $500 to $2,000. And those numbers are intended to reflect the full cost recovery of working on those kinds of applications. In the case of road easements and also some utility license transactions, the proposal would be also to charge some additional inspection fees should that be needed. So, for example, this very large pipeline that just is going through northern Minnesota, we in DNR spent a fair amount of time on inspections to ensure that the natural resources were protected while that pipeline was installed. And the idea would be to recover the cost of state employees conducting those inspections. So that's the other major change item that's in this budget. Excuse me. And the last item then.
If you could just wait a second. Representative Jill had a question.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius and Director Reyes. Give me just one little piece of information on those easements, the road easements particularly. Now, for temporary access, for example, crossing state land to get to a paper company land or some other land, that will be different. A road easement, as I understand it, is something that's a permanent, it's filed, those types of things. Can you explain that just a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, the Division of Forestry does have, for example, a temporary crossing permit that they issue, and I don't know what the cost of that is. It's minimal. And it's for those situations where for logging purposes or something like that, temporary access is needed. And what's being referred to in the change item would be those permanent road easements where someone needs permanent access to a property for whatever reason, and that puts a permanent encumbrance on the land. And so it's a different type of transaction.
Thanks.
The last item then is land records system, and you may recall that in the current biennium, We're in the middle of a four-year project to update and modernize the department's land record system. And it is a four-year project, and we're in the middle of it. And we are asking through this budget to spend the second half of the project be funded. And that request would be for about $1.4 million for the upcoming biennium. And that should be sufficient for the department to complete that project.
Let's talk to us about how that relates to the easements that you hold that you're now beginning to figure out where they are and how we're going to enforce them, et cetera.
Madam Chair, the easements, is that road easements or conservation
easements? Conservation easements, all the easements we hold, but we were talking about the conservation easements and not having a system to know where they were or what the easements were for, so because of that we had a lack of checking up on them to see if we really did have what we paid for.
Madam Chair, that's a fair description. There are many conservation easements that are held by the state where there is not a good place to go one spot and find out where the easement is, what the purpose of the easement is, the terms and conditions, what sort of right of access the public has to those lands, really what the state bought. And so one product from this land record system will be documentation and an actual scanned image of the lease document or the easement document itself for all of those conservation easements, along with many other land characteristics that will be in this land record system. And so it will enable DNR, but more importantly, the public, to have access to that information so that it's fully disclosed and transparent, and people have an opportunity to know and understand what the state owns.
Have you determined yet how many of these conservation easements we hold?
Madam Chair, as you know, there is a focus on conservation easements through an LCCMR project. The department's doing it. It's a three-year project. And I don't have that number in the top of my head. We do know that number now. We have collected all of them. It's something greater than 1,000 and less than 2,000, but I just can't recall the number. I could get that for you because we do know that.
Okay. It would be helpful if you would share that.
Be happy to.
Will the LCCMR process or funding, how much of the problem will that cover? Let's put it that way.
Madam Chair, there are three parts to that project. The first is to identify all of those easements that the state holds. That DNR manages. It's also then part of the project to capture those and collect the information, and that's part of what's going on at the moment. It goes on then to have a portion that looks at monitoring those easements and make recommendations for a mechanism to do long-term monitoring of those easement conditions. So in other words, the state has a right of interest in that land and just ensuring that right of interest is upheld and the easement conditions are maintained. And so those are the three main parts of that program. And towards the end of the project, I think we'll be prepared to come with that recommendation for both a mechanism to do the monitoring and perhaps how that potentially could be funded.
I'm understanding from that at least the first part between what you're doing and the LCCMR project, that we will know where all the easements are and what rights the state does hold. So that will be complete when these two projects are complete 2 years from now. Is that what I'm understanding?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Good. Okay. That's the important thing. So it feels like the job's going to get done. Good job.
Okay. This is a very important project to us, Madam Chair, and these dollars are coming from different accounts throughout the division because forestry, fish and wildlife, ecological resources, all the different land types that we own need to be mapped and monitored and maintained. So you can click on a parcel, you'll be able to access the deed or the easement language, the data that's there. It's my hope that in the future we might be able to do some satellite imagery easement type stuff. I mean, the capabilities are endless, how you might be able to take a state-of-the-art system and do some enforcement, do things like that that we've talked about in other committees as well. And if you look at some of the counties that have online GIS tools, we are taking that data and using that data wherever possible, correcting it, making sure what we have is digitized into the right scale, but looking at all the efficiencies to make sure that what we create works with everybody else and it all talks to each other as well. So.
Representative Torkelson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, you know, as a as a rookie here, I don't know all the history, but what I don't understand is why did we get so far behind on keeping track of these easements in the past. It seems like it's something that should have been an ongoing process in years past.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the system that we have, we are keeping track. It's just, if you were able to come over, and I would love to be able to give anybody a tour of our current system right now, it's a big electriver system, filing cabinets like they have in if you want to go to pull a bill over in house research, for example, house information. So we have a old computer that you can look up the transaction, the parcel, then you'd have to go pull the file and manually do your research. What we're doing now is everything will be online. You'll be able to be digitized and computerized. So to do that transaction, we do know the easement, but it's all manual kind of research and work to pull them up, and there's not a one database size that fits everything that's there, so we're bringing our land record system into the 21st century. It's rather confusing to describe. It's probably easier to show how we actually do it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. What's the total cost of this project to modernize this record-keeping system?
Madam Chair, Representative, the current biennium is a expenditure of $3.2 million, and request is for $1.4 million, so the total of this project for the land record system would be $4.6 million.
And approximately how many records are involved?
Oh, Madam Chair, again, I don't have that number in the top of my head, but the state owns 12 million acres of mineral rights, about 5.5 million acres of surface rights, and so, you know, there's deeds for all of those. In addition to that, there are thousands of transactions, like leases, licenses, easements, that sort of thing. I can get that number, but it's many, many, many thousands of individual records. I would say tens of thousands of records.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the director. Where does the cost come in? It seems to me we'd just be hiring a staff to be scanning these documents. So where does that additional cost come in?
Madam Chair, this project is more than just scanning the deeds and getting them into an electronic version. The system that we have now was created in the mid-80s, and so some of the stuff that you can do, like with GIS and look at maps and put on layers, you can't do that with this system. It's more or less a file cabinet that you need to have specific computer codes to ask questions of it. It's not like a modern system where you can go online and query it. And so it's more than just scanning these deeds and documents. It's making a system that will use those modern kind of things like mapping and GIS, so be able to pull up and not only look at a deed but figure out where this land is out in the landscape. And the idea here is that this is not just a tool that DNR managers would use. There'll be public access to this. So something to think of through the internet where you can then pull up what the state land records are, and really no one understands what the state owns. That's the purpose of this project. So it's more than just the scanning and making that digital.
Madam Chair, it is our hope to, at some point in time, if possible, before session ends, to do a little dry run display, kind of show you what we're looking at. It's really taking that map, kind of click on it, be able to take a picture of the actual land with boundaries, click on it, you can get the deed, you could find out when we bought it, what the price was, what restrictions are on there, all of the actual information that would be available on that parcel, and use that, and make it open to the public to be able to use this and really understand what the state land assets are that we own and where they are, and everything like that. Part of the work is fitting all of our data boundaries together, making sure that they all fit together, because right now we kind of take our parcels at a 40 acre parcel, and we need to rectify all the actual boundaries. So there's a lot of technical aspects to the project that we can certainly spend more time talking about with you if you're very interested in. We'd love to have you come over and take a look at what we have right now, because it's kind of old. So.
Madam Chair, the system, if I could add, the system we have now works very well for what it was designed for originally in the 1980s. It more is just a file cabinet and a system for billing. So we have all these transactions to send out an annual payment for a lease and that sort of thing. And that's what it was built for, and it does that well. It's just there's so much more available today.
Madam Chair, I have two questions. One is, what about cross-pollination with the other agencies? So if you're going through the data and you have land mapping information with easements, and there happens to be an easement from another agency, I mean, is that getting integrated into your system?
Madam Chair, I think we're I'm about to take that step off the edge of the plank here, because I'm near the limit of my knowledge, but I have to think about it. And it is being coordinated through that statewide computer consortium, so we are working with them the goal would be to have that happen. Now, having said that, can you use the system DNR is developing and have the ability to see everything that every other state agency has through that system? I don't know, and I don't think so. But I think it's capable of looking at what the state has and also looking at what the involved or others have on whatever system they have. But okay, Sam, it's like the last step in that plank, and so would like more information on that. Really should have the project manager come before you and explain how that integration works.
My follow-up is that we have other agencies or other entities that come to us wanting updating of records and wanting, we've had proposals for LIDAR mapping where you would get actual geographic information, which I could see would be good to be integrated in here. And we've had the Southeast 7 County flood area that's been LIDAR mapped. We have individual counties that have been LIDAR mapped. We have the Red River Valley that's supposed to be LIDAR mapped. But we have people coming and wanting the rest of the state LIDAR map. So when they come to us and want hundreds of thousands of dollars for LIDAR mapping, my question is, does this get integrated into your system so there can be easement mapping on there? And then we also put money in for drainage records modernization and digitization. And I would think particularly up in the Northwest, so if Bowser's doing drainage records modernization and digitization, is that getting integrated into your system? I know, you know, at least 10 or 15 years ago there was like in state planning something called LIMIC, the Land Management Information System. I don't, state planning doesn't exist anymore, but we have folks coming to us wanting money for different pieces of modernizing records, and I think we've thought it's a good idea to get these things off of paper. But how, you know, each group comes to us and then holds that data. We want to make sure that it's coming together.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, those are excellent questions. The LIDAR information is something that we have staff that actually works with those people on the LIDAR projects that are there. So I need to go back. We need to talk about this really seriously, because as those projects are developed, we want to make sure that they are maintained or have the ability to be maintained in one system. Our project that we're developing is based upon a limited general fund appropriation from last biennium and dollars from Game and Fish, Fish and Wildlife Division, the other divisions talking about the actual state lands that we own and operate. So it's something that we do need to talk about. We can come back. I'd really like to talk about that with you and our technical staff and maybe the other agencies, is how do we develop a statewide system that has all the data that you need, that you can click on and get the layers that are there, especially that drainage information and the LIDAR stuff. We're talking about actual land ownership. You're talking more of land management type data as well, and type of topographical and things like that. But it is important to have it all in one place, so we need to figure out how to do that.
I think that what you all have been bringing up is critical, because the system standing alone is not useful without these other layers that are being developed. So I hear the need for us to make sure that this all works together. I don't know whether we do another hearing on this or not. Members can suggest how we proceed, but I think I hear a consensus that folks want the same outcome. Am I getting that correct? So we want to make sure that this land record system interfaces, if that's the right word, maybe, with all these other systems of topography, etc. So we need to have a conversation about that. Is that correct? Am I getting that correct? Representative Hamilton, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this is disappointing. You know, there should have been gradual updates going on from the beginning. You know, I can understand in agriculture, we've been having electronic data, et cetera, going out with GPS, marking boundaries, wetlands, tile intakes, collaborating manure application, analyzing NPK, et cetera. And so now I get a better understanding why the government questions our practices and questions or has a distrust in our practices, because the government appears to be stuck in the 80s. You know, the private sector, we've been moving on. We've been embracing technology. We're way ahead of the game. And so that's why it's so disappointing to hear what we're hearing today. And that's where a lot of the distrust and disconnect comes in, because, again, it appears like we're stuck in the 80s. You know, the same thing for mining. As far as the additional changes that have taken place that are environmentally friendly, et cetera, et cetera, we got to get on board. We got to catch up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more follow-up question, and this is just kind of for my own information. Have you looked at taking private bids on any of these update procedures at all?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is private. This is being bid out to a private vendor.
I think we need to proceed here. I don't see any other questions, but I also think that we need to have a conversation, a committee meeting conversation, about how we make sure that all of this information is integrated. Am I getting that correct? All right. We will make sure that we take care of that. I can't give you a date on that yet, but we will have a conversation about that, because I think that is critical. When I hear that folks want to add to LIDAR, how does that interface? Who pays for it? When do we get all of this so that people can see everything together? That's where we should be going. Okay, with that...
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll move on to Fish and Wildlife.
But first of all, let's thank you for a good report and well laid out. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification on the spreadsheet and the fact sheet that we have. The spreadsheet before you talks about the full biennium 10 and 11, so the numbers are the two fiscal years combined. Our fact sheet actually is laid out year by year, so I apologize for any confusion, but just keep that in mind as we're talking about change items in particular. They are based upon the full biennial impact on the spreadsheet, but it's broken down year by year on the fact sheet. And actually for this next division, we'll be working off of that, the change item fact sheet, the general fund reduction fact sheet, and there are three other individual ones that focus on other change items. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll bring up, introduce Director David Shad of the Fish and Wildlife Division, and we'll talk about their budget.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. For the record, my name is Dave Shad. I'm the Fish and Wildlife Director for the Department of Natural Resources. Our spreadsheet here is formatted in the same manner as Lands and Minerals. I'll be walking through five strategic objectives and some of the outcomes and impacts of the governor's budget on those five strategic objectives, but maybe just first a little bit of context. We're primarily funded by user fees. The Game and Fish Fund has traditionally supported the lion's share of the work that we do in our division. The governor's budget proposes largely eliminating general fund support for the work that we do. It would eliminate about $5.5 million for the biennium and general fund. There's a little bit of build back for some TV work, as we'll see, but largely the general fund support for the division will be eliminated under this budget. There are some additional initiatives that we'll talk about a little bit later, but overall there'll be about $2.4 million less support in appropriated dollars for the Fish and Wildlife Division as a result of this budget. The first strategic objective has to do with managing fish and wildlife populations and providing related recreational opportunity, hunting, angling, trapping, and wildlife viewing opportunities. Overall, we will see a 3.5% reduction in effort related to this strategy. That's a result of about a $2 million general fund reduction related to this work. We will maintain a priority for some of the disease work that we're doing. We're seeing emerging threats on both the fish and wildlife side related to diseases, chronic wasting disease, bovine tuberculosis, VHS on the fish side, and many others. Just 5 years ago, we really didn't have much of a disease program. Right now, it's a major priority for us and one that we're allocating increasing funding for. So you can see there a couple of outcomes related to ongoing surveillance for chronic wasting disease. We did have a fourth domestic cervid herd, deer and elk herd, that was found to have chronic wasting disease just last month down in southeastern Minnesota in Olmsted County. We'll be focusing some increased surveillance work looking at hunter-harvested deer down in that part of the state to ensure that that CWD hasn't been passed to the wild deer herd. That's also a focus for us because of the presence of chronic wasting disease in the wild deer herd in Wisconsin, in the proximity of that CWD infection in Wisconsin to the southeastern corner of Minnesota. So that will be an emphasis for us. We're also focusing increasing resources, both state and federal funding, doing surveillance for VHS, both in conjunction with some of our spawn take sites, some of our walleye rearing operations, and also some of our water bodies that we feel are most at risk from introduction of this disease, the St. Louis River estuary, the Mississippi River, and so forth. As far as the impact of the general fund reduction in this objective, we'll be reducing some of the population surveys and the harvest surveys that we do. For example, some of the lake and stream survey work that we do on smaller bodies of water. We might right now be getting back to those waters once every 3 to 5 years to assess fisheries populations. That gap will be increasing to perhaps 7 to 10 years. We will maintain our survey efforts on our large lakes, the lakes that have statewide or regional importance and that have very large resorts and tourism industries associated with them. But on these smaller lakes, we're just not going to be able to have the staffing to get out and do survey work as often. And as a result of that, we're not going to have quite as good a handle on what the status of those populations are. And at some point, recreational opportunity may suffer. We're also going to be cutting back a little bit on some of the research that we do. We're kind of unique within the Department of Natural Resources. We do have research functions in both our fisheries and our wildlife sections to provide the information and the science support for the work that we do, and we're going to be cutting back on some of those projects, contracts with the University of Minnesota and so forth. So at some point, that science support for the work we do will be diminished as well.
Can you be a little bit more specific about what science is telling you and what will be foregone here?
Madam Chair, we don't have specific projects identified as far as what we won't be doing. An example would be we contract with the University of Minnesota for some genetic support for our fisheries management program. We don't have in-house genetic expertise, so we contract with the university, a genetic fisheries genetic scientist there to help us better understand the impact that these different genetic populations of brook trout, for example, or walleye or whatever it might be, how we need to consider some of that genetic information in our stocking programs and so forth. So that would be an example of a contract that we're going to be considering reducing here as part of this reduction.
And what's the cost of that contract?
I'm not sure about that. I'll have to get back to you.
Please do.
Okay. There's three new initiatives associated with this strategic objective. The first is a one-time general fund initiative to increase our work in responding to the bovine tuberculosis outbreak in northwestern Minnesota. We've been dealing with this since 2005 when TB was first found in cattle. It spilled over into deer. Since that time, we've had a very aggressive program in trying to detect the extent of that infection in deer. So far, we've tested nearly 6,000 deer, have found TB in 24 of those animals. We've had very aggressive programs to reduce deer populations in that part of the state. In fact, we've got sharpshooters on the ground as we speak, reducing deer in this core area where the TB-infected farms and all the TB-positive deer have been found. And this general fund appropriation would fund both the surveillance work and the deer population reduction work in that part of the state. In fiscal year 08, this program cost us $763,000. All of that was from Game and Fish Fund with the exception of $131,000 of general fund support. This would provide general fund support for that program. We felt that hunters shouldn't necessarily have to pay the bill here, that this is a cattle disease that's impacting deer populations, and so we felt that it was appropriate that general fund dollars targeted for this initiative. The second initiative is to capture revenue from the new walleye stamp that was approved by the legislature last year. That stamp is now available for sale. It's a voluntary stamp, so we're unsure how much revenue that $5 stamp will be generating. This would appropriate up to $285,000 per year and make it available, assuming that sales supported that level of of appropriation. We would intend to use these additional dollars to buy additional, the dollars are directed in statute to be used for walleye stocking programs. We would intend to use these new revenues to buy additional fish from the private sector to ensure that we could meet our stocking goals, both in terms of pounds and numbers, in states across lakes across the state, and also to replace some of our least productive walleye rearing operations. We produce about 160,000 pounds of walleye fingerling for our program each year. Of that 160,000 pounds, 40,000 pounds is now purchased from the private sector. 120,000 pounds is produced in state waters by our state employees, and we've got some fairly unproductive ponds, for example, in northeastern Minnesota that we believe we could make better use of those dollars by replacing some of that production, buying those fish from the private sector, and reduce our overall cost and improve efficiency of that program.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director Shad. I've got a question. So would the $570,000 be used to buy more than the approximate current level for the last 3 years of $40,000? And then would the total be above and beyond? So in 2009, we would potentially have more walleye stocking than was in the last 3 years?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, it would be new pounds, and it would there'd be basically two purposes for it. It would ensure that we're able to meet our stocking goals. We're not going to just start putting more walleyes in the lakes because there's more money available. We have very specific targets for each lake, both in terms of pounds and in numbers. We traditionally focused on meeting the pound, 1.1 pounds per year per literal acre sample, but we haven't paid much attention to the numbers. The most efficient stocking is if we stock fingerlings of a size about 20 per pound. In some cases, because of lack of winter kill and that kind of thing, we're stocking bigger fish than that. And so we're meeting the pounds, but there's fewer fish coming into the lake. We can use some of these additional privately purchased fish to make sure that we're not only meeting the pound objective, but also the numbers objective. So in some cases, some lakes will be receiving some additional fish as a result of this. We would also like to use some of this new dollars to replace some of the state-produced fish. We've got some ponds that are less efficient. We can free up some of that production, shift it to the private sector, save some money, and it makes financial sense to do that. So it would be some additional pounds and some replacing existing pounds that the state is now producing.
Just real quick, Madam Chair, I don't want to take a lot of time because, as the Director knows, we do have a bill to look at this more fully, and I believe we'll be in Representative Dale's committee in the future dealing with that. But this currently, if I'm not mistaken, the hunting is putting in more money than the fishing, and so you're looking at opportunities to where the fish, right now the fish licenses are ending up using some of the hunting license money, if I'm getting this right, and we're looking for opportunities to where we'll be more fair with the fisheries, and the walleye stamp is a good idea in that respect. I think that should help us. So that, I guess that's more a comment, and just if you could confirm that is true, that the fisheries currently is using some of the hunting stamp money, and we're working to try and equate that.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, you're correct. We've been working with the Game and Fish Fund Budget Oversight Committee on this issue for a couple of years, and basically anglers are underfunded. We're spending more on fisheries programs than we're bringing in with revenue from anglers, and the opposite is true for hunters. We're actually bringing more in hunting revenue than we're spending on wildlife programs. So So hunters are pointing out that they're subsidizing angling or fisheries programs, and this is a new source of revenue, and you're right, it does help address that problem.
Director Shad, when you said that the private sector produces walleye cheaper than you do, one of the reasons, of course, is because, well, let me put it differently. Have you done a full cost accounting, or is this just a dollar and cent thing? Are you looking at the impact on the resources that you manage when you do that accounting? In other words, what is the use of the wetlands? How much of that resource is being used, and do you account for that in your saying that the private sector produces walleye cheaper?
Madam Chair, it is a financial analysis, and what we found is for the last 3 years, we've been able to purchase walleyes for about $4 to $5 per pound cheaper from the private sector than we can raise them ourselves. A big reason for that is they use some more intensive methods. We take a very extensive approach to our walleye rearing program. We stock fry in wetlands in the spring on many acres of wetlands, and then come back in the fall, and some produce and some don't. And we kind of take whatever we get there. The private sector, when they put those fry in those wetlands in the spring, they have an investment there that they manage more intensively, and they're able to provide those fish at this point cheaper than we can raise them. And that in part is why we'd like to replace some of our least productive ponds with some additional privately purchased fish. But there are some additional costs, environmental costs associated with that. We do have an ongoing effort right now to develop some best management practices. The legislature last year authorized some funding. We're working with the University of Minnesota, the University of St. Thomas, to develop some BMPs. We expect to have those by June of 2010, so about a year and a half from now we should have those BMPs. We would anticipate that we would use those BMPs, and by the way, we're working with a variety of stakeholders as we develop those, the aquaculture industry, some of the waterfowl hunting groups, that sort of thing, are all going to be very involved as we develop these best management practices. But we would expect that our steak production would incorporate those best management practices into how we raise walleyes out there. We'd also anticipate that we'd look at incorporating those best management practices into the contract that we let for private purchase of fish.
However, you failed to answer my question. And my question was, there are environmental costs, and you acknowledge that there are environmental costs, and you haven't factored that in. So for full cost accounting, if you would bring us back the environmental costs of raising fish intensively, and for members who maybe not know what that is, it is feeding fish, and some private folks do that. DNR does not feed fish. It can ruin a wetland. So that's because we don't have that full cost accounting, it's hard to for us to measure in this committee, which is a financial committee, what the true cost is. So if you can bring us the full cost accounting, that would be very helpful. Representative Anzo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does the science tell you, if anything, about natural reproduction of the stocked fish lake to lake to lake, comparing the privately reared fish with
the walleye that's reared in by the public sector in the state rearing ponds, and secondly, assuming that the science shows that in one or both scenarios, public versus private, there are lakes in which the stocked walleye does not reproduce, what's the policy on continuing to stock in those lakes where there is no natural reproduction?
Madam Chair, Representative Amsdell, we stock walleyes basically in two different situations. In some cases, it's simply a put and take fishery. These are lakes that aren't natural walleye lakes. They don't have walleye spawning habitat and wouldn't naturally provide walleye angling opportunity. We can stock walleyes in those lakes to provide that angling opportunity without adversely impacting other fisheries populations in those lakes. And so we simply put them in, the anglers catch them, and there's no opportunity to create a self-sustaining walleye population. The other situation is to augment or bolster walleye production on some of those natural walleye lakes. In some cases, these are marginal walleye lakes where natural reproduction is very hit or miss. You might get a successful year class 1 out of 5 years, 1 out of 6 years, something like that. And so we can use stocking to kind of smooth that out a little bit and provide more dependable walleye angling opportunity. In other cases, these are generally very very strong and naturally reproducing walleye lakes. But again, 1 year out of three, 1 year out of two, 1 year out of five, we might get a bad year, and we can use stocking to again even that out and ensure that angling success doesn't kind of dip up and down as much as it would under a natural situation. As far as how stocked fish actually might eventually reproduce and contribute to that population, I'm not aware that we've done research on that. You would actually have to follow those fish and determine. It would be difficult to determine what contribution those stocked fish are making to future years' reproduction. But we do pay very close attention to genetics, and that's one reason we do. We want to stock the right genetic fish in those basins to ensure that we're not adversely affecting the genetics of existing walleyes in that lake, but also to make sure that the genetics of those fish are best suited to allowing those fish to survive and hopefully reproduce in that lake and contribute to that population in the future.
However, you just your earlier testimony said that you're cutting back on research on genetics. It's one of the things you're cutting back on.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be counterproductive right now when this whole stocking issue is huge and we haven't figured out the role habitat or poor habitat plays in all of this. And it seems that we are doing some pretty unscientific things right now, and maybe some good science would help us all out. Do you think?
Madam Chair, I don't disagree that science and good science needs to be a part of everything we do, and including this. It's with in these budget conditions, we're having to make some very tough decisions, and we're not going to throw science out the window, but we're going to be very strategic about this, about the specific projects that we defer as a result of this current budget challenge.
But the bigger question of even not having really good habitat science for how our fish are either naturally producing or not naturally producing is something that seems to me is we're really late in coming to the table and getting that job done. Are you all ready to start to work on that? I mean, there have been LCCMR pots of money sitting out there that seem to say, here's an opportunity for the DNR, and those opportunities were foregone, and it surprised me a little bit. I don't know whether an opportunity like that is in the new LCCMR proposal or not.
Yeah, Madam Chair, as you know, we did propose a fairly ambitious lake monitoring program to LCCMR, and it's been recommended for funding. We call it our SLAPE program, and it's going to set up a Sentinel Lake program to monitor over time the impact that thing changes, like, for example, climate change or changes in the watershed or changes as far as development patterns around a lake. Might have on all aspects of the lake, water quality, fisheries populations, invertebrate populations, vegetation, and that sort of thing. So we are taking a serious look at this. We're also developing a proposal around looking at some of our large walleye lakes and doing some long-term monitoring of the relationship between habitat and population and spawning success and that sort of thing. So we are looking at that. We are making some of that research a priority at this point.
Well, the deep lake, I don't think, helps us with the current problem that we have, and we do certainly have a current problem. Mm-hmm. The other might, but it does seem that we should spend some more time concentrating on this. Representative Scalzi had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Shad, I it would seem to me that the research on genetics that we can't afford to do through the general fund and also the cost to bring back water quality in a water body should be borne by the people who have requested the permit and maybe have ruined the water body. And we had some tours last year, year before, and we were able to see an upfront, close look at some of the water bodies that were being used by some of the private folks with the concentrated industrial use. And those water bodies were very much degraded. They had no vegetation to speak of, no aquatic vegetation, and they had the water quality, the color was changed. So it would seem to me, and that's one question, can we determine the cost to bring back the aquatic vegetation and the water quality, which is what the DNR does. That's part of your mission, is to make our waters good. And there was, when we passed the dedicated funding amendment, there's money in the Clean Water Legacy, and I've been sitting here kind of waiting to see what's going to happen when the PCA says this water body is impaired for these reasons. It's going to cost the taxpayers and the sales taxpayers to bring this body of water back, when we know firsthand that the DNR is issuing a permit to someone who's degrading that water. So it doesn't make much sense to put more taxpayer dollars into bringing it back when we've all already allowed someone to degrade it. We've got to come to terms with that balance. And there was a lawsuit recently settled in Minnesota where there was a ruined water body, and no one can raise minnows privately in that water body, and because of the sucker minnows that the DNR had, allowed to sell the eggs and allowed. So there, that's the other issue. There's lawsuits waiting to happen. That one was settled. So my question to you is, can you determine these costs, genetic research and water quality rehabilitation, into the permit? And then the second question is regarding this lawsuit that's recently been settled. Are there other lawsuits pending, and is this another part on the horizon that we should be aware of as you go forward in your work? Because to me, the DNR is the gatekeeper. The DNR has the ethics, and they want to see the waters continue to be for future generations. And I don't see that in the other piece of the puzzle.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, on your first question as far as costs, I assume you're talking about the cost of the impairment that might occur to a wetland as a result of ring fish in that wetland and the cost of remediating that harm. We have proposed a new fee structure for our aquaculture permits. Right now, it's a flat fee. It's not linked to the number of acres that are under permit, and we're proposing a new fee structure that would fully support the costs associated with that permit program and with some of the monitoring that we're doing as a result of some of those fish rearing activities in wetlands. And in fact, we've got some policy language that would allow us to go ahead and develop that fee structure through an expedited process rather than through a very lengthy typical rulemaking process. And the other point I guess I'd raise, and it's perhaps why I got so long-winded with the chair earlier on our best management practices, but a lot of the science related to how fish impact wetlands is very new. It's emerging. A lot of it is a result of the work that we've done here in Minnesota and that we funded through the Department of Natural Resources to take a look at this. This is some very new science. The best management practice process is helping us pull all that science together. It's bringing some of the top scientists in the country on this topic together and trying to get a better understanding of exactly what these impacts are. It's very different for walleyes, for example, than it is for sucker minnows. Fathead minnows are a whole different story. And it's very complex. We're learning all the time, and I really do think that this best management practice process is going to really hopefully provide all of us a better understanding of what these impacts are and what we need to do moving forward to make sure that if we continue to use wetlands to rear fish, that it's done in a sustainable manner.
Ms. Chair, and the second question was regarding the lawsuit that was settled in Minnesota, and are there further lawsuits pending that you're aware of, and it is something that we should be watching?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, my understanding, that lawsuit related to a private aquaculturist who obtained access to a wetland that was and the ownership of that wetland was shared by several landowners, and one of those other landowners sued and said his riparian rights were impacted. As you said, that lawsuit was settled. I'm not aware of any other lawsuits that are pending that are similar in nature to that. But I think there is that issue is still out there. For the wetlands that we use, the rearing that we use for the state-produced walleyes, we do attempt to notify all the riparian landowners on those wetlands that we're using.
Just have one follow-up question, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I was at the DNR roundtable in Minnesota. We don't have ducks. North Dakota has ducks. So maybe you can help me out here. In North Dakota, you cannot bring in a white sucker as bait. It's illegal. And in Minnesota, the DNR sells eggs for people to raise white suckers in our waters. Why is there such a difference? And North Dakota has ducks. That's where our duck hunters in Minnesota are going to hunt ducks. Why can't we learn from North Dakota and maybe not allow the rearing of white suckers or not allow the bringing in of a white sucker as bait like North Dakota does?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, white suckers are one of the species that we don't know much about. Actually, most of the research we've done has focused on walleyes, fathead minnows, and the interaction between those two species and wetland qualities. There is some ongoing research on white suckers. I think, again, the BMP process hopefully will clarify what some of those white sucker related impacts are. They're a very popular bait fish. Winter anglers especially really prefer those larger white sucker minnows. And to get that size, it takes 2 to 3 years, and so there is actually quite a large acreage of wetland that's under permit that's tied up in white sucker production, probably more than walleye production is my guess here. So white suckers is an important issue. We're trying to learn more about it, and I expect it will have a focus in this BMP, these recommendations that come from this BMP process.
There was a question that Representative Scalzi asked that you didn't answer. And what you talked about in your new fee structure are costs associated with permitting.
Mm-hmm.
Good. That's great. Needs to be done.
Right.
We don't have any money. And people should pay their own costs. But you didn't talk about the cost of restoring a wetland that has been degraded by intensive rearing of walleye because they're being fed. And so if you would also answer that question, I know you can't do that now, but as you're doing the full cost accounting, let's have some numbers around that. And I didn't think, I thought the new science, well, we won't, I don't think we need to get into that right now, but Representative Dill.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, through all this, you maybe have got to what I was going to get at, but I want to just zero in a little bit on what the Chair first brought up. This bill is going to become, the McNamara bill will be in front of my committee sometime soon, and so we need the information that not only includes the environmental impact of the wetlands that you folks have quantified, but also if we can get the information, the environmental mitigation that the privately leased wetlands require as well, so that we can have a correct comparison. And I maybe you got that out of all of this, but I wanted to make sure that you knew what we needed for our committee. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dill, I think one of the issues there is walleye raised without intensive feeding and walleye raised with intensive feeding. So there are actually two cost accountings here, and they're different. But the third piece of that puzzle is the other question that Representative Scalzi raised. And what is the liability, which has been the thing that has worried me all along about this, what is the liability to the state because we are not following the law and that somebody is going to sue us and say DNR didn't follow the law in making its permits, and so the cost of the restoration falls to the state rather than to the bait dealer who said, oh, I'm bankrupt or I don't have the money. So that is such a likely scenario. And, you know, I remember last year, I don't know what that lawsuit's doing now, where a judge in another case literally brought in DNR where it wasn't, DNR wasn't petitioned in a lawsuit, but the judge brought in DNR because the judge saw that DNR was going to be a deep pocket in a lawsuit. And it was a wetlands lawsuit. It wasn't this particular one, but it was a wetlands lawsuit. And the finding was like, by the judge, was like $6 or $7 million against the state. So $7 million against the state. So, you know, I do worry about these things. So as you are looking at the full cost accounting, you've got to look at that issue too. Representative McNamara is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate you taking some time on this issue. It's very important, and I do think we need to take into account the environmental impact, both negative and positive. You're right, the private sector does do it differently. They introduce many times the fatheads, additional fatheads. And I want to be sure that I say additional, because they're rearing in ponds that already have fatheads, and then they're adding more fatheads. The net effect is we don't need to be in as many waters. We can be in a much, much smaller number of waters than we're currently in. They also, their best management practices currently include removing the rough fish. the DNR's policy, at least in my instance where the DNR came in and our lake that was infested with fatheads, put the walleyes in and just came back at the end of the year. They monitored a little bit along the way, but did not remove rough fish. Thank goodness there was only one white sucker in the whole lake. But my bill, just so members do know, our bill does not deal with white suckers. It will not allow the private sector to take over any of the DNRs or transition. This is about walleyes and muskies is all it is. Madam Chair, we do need to reduce the number of waters that we're doing white suckers in and figure out a way to do them better. White suckers, bullheads, and carps are the problem. They don't have those in North Dakota. They have ducks. They have fatheads. They have lots of fatheads in their lake. But they don't have the fish that it looks like are messing us up. I actually, Director Shad and Madam Chair, I think that Representative Scalzi and yourself and myself and probably Representative Hackbart and Representative Dillon and everybody else, Representative Anzalk and all the folks around here actually are on the same page. I believe that when we look at this and look at the best management practices, there is a solution here. And I think we're going to move in that direction that we have to. We have so many destroyed wetlands, and many of us have seen it firsthand in Minnesota. It's the rough fish and the suckers that are really messing us up. Thank you, Madam.
We will, and I do have a list here. Another thing we'll maybe do this summer is LCGMR has funded a wonderful carp study. It would be good to get that education for committee members. So I think science is going to really help us out here. When we're talking about all of this, let's be very careful of our language. I'm not worried about anything raised in a pond on somebody's private property. That's not our problem. Wetlands where there are riparian owners who rights are probably being stolen, because that's what they would, that would be their allegation in a lawsuit. It'd be very hard to win a lawsuit against that kind of allegation. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Shad, the issue here is a little bit different for me. I just have a request and in regarding to the stocking of walleye issue. You are doing some marking of these stockfish, so you can do recapture, et cetera, so you got some statistics. Is anybody doing any fecundity work? Do we know that these recaptured stockfish are having the same reproductive success? We talked about you don't really have any measure of reproduction. Well, I think that's one, and I'm curious as to what that's telling you. I just asked that. I'd like to see it if you have it.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I'm not sure if anybody's doing that. I know we've been interested in that question. I'm not sure anybody's figured out how to get at that, but I'll check with our research biologists and get back to you on that.
Madam Chair, it's not rocket science. Mm-hmm. You know, we're milking those walleyes regularly. You just count eggs.
You could handle that like that. Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. Real briefly, I think the one common thread that we all share is we all know we have to spend money more wisely and better than ever. And I was a little concerned 10 or 12 minutes ago when I heard you say in one scenario, on a certain number of lakes with walleye stocking, the DNR's approach is catch and take. And then in a whole other area of the state's waters, the philosophy is through slots to protect the resource and minimize the take. And how does that jive, and how are we really maximizing the resources by trying to be all things to all lakes with walleyes? And I can assure you, in coffee shops all over northern Minnesota this morning, this is the topic as we approach spring. So what kind of signals are we sending to the angler?
Madam Chair, Representative Anvil, we're having a lot of those same discussions internally. We've heard from anglers over the years that they want to catch fish to eat, but they also want to catch large fish. We entered into this approach of individual lake management within the last 10 years, where we're tailoring regulations to individual bodies of water to produce what anglers tell us they want. If they want more big fish in that body of water, we're looking at a suite of regulations that can provide that. Or if they want a better average size of fish that they're catching that they can bring home and eat, we can tailor regulations to that. But with that comes complexity, and with that comes some unknown consequences. For example, we're looking at the impact that some of these regulations have on creating a lot of large fish in some of these systems, and the impact that those large fish might have on reproductive success and that sort of thing. And again, we're fairly new within the last 5 to 10 years of some of these regulations, and it takes some time for a lot of those impacts to play out. So we're in the process of evaluating how those regulations are working and working with some of the walleye interests out there to say, do we want to keep doing this? Is it working or is it not working? Are there some better options out there? So we understand that there's a lot of discussion of that in the coffee shop. We're having those same discussions.
Two more questions before we adjourn for the day. Representative Gill, did you have one of those two questions?
I'm on a different subject, so if someone else has something on minnows.
Our fiscal analyst, I want to ask our fiscal analyst to help us out here with another issue.
Madam Chair and Director Shad, this year we're trying to change the budgeting process a little bit, and the DNR has been really helpful and successful in doing it. But I think that we're trying to do it with a whole budget, but when we're looking at change items, we really should focus on those because they're new things, and let's start out right on them is kind of what I'm saying. And I'm looking at your change items in your handout page. Under key measures and outcomes, it says outcomes would include more stocking of fry fingerlings into fishable waters of the state. Frankly, that's not even an output. I mean, in your spreadsheet, you do talk about 160,000 pounds of walleye, but it's really, this change item is really not getting at answering the question that we're trying to do. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to budget based on goals and based on results that are measurable results. Now, my question, and the reason we're doing that is try to be effective and efficient in budgeting. So my question, what goal is this? What goal is this fulfilling of the DNR? Can you answer? I don't know if you could answer that right now. If you could,
Madam Chair, actually, it's better fishing, and if you look on the spreadsheet on the far right column under the outcome description, you can see the objective. For example, in 2008. We stocked 160,594 pounds. They averaged 22.8 fingerlings per pound. 2007, they were a little larger, so the fish per pound was a little smaller. But that second sentence there is really key, and that is that our netting results, when we go back in stock lakes and look at the outcome, what has happened as far as walleye populations goal, we've actually seen a slight decrease. In other words, we're stocking more fingerlings than ever, or more pounds than ever, but the actual result is, as far as what we're seeing in our nets and in our surveys, has declined slightly, and we're interested in figuring out why this is. Some of it has to do with the fact that maybe we're not always meeting that 20 per pound mark that we're
we're stocky, we're meeting our pound goal, but not our number goal. And so one of the reasons that we're targeting some of the new walleye stamp funding to perhaps buy some additional fish from the private sector to make sure that we meet both the pound and the numbers goal is to see if we can get that line moving the other direction and actually produce, you know, better fishing in those lakes. The measure of that would be what we see in our nets.
Madam Chair, Director Shad, I did ask this question because I did read that note, and and once again, I have to say what you're offering here are outputs. You're offering numbers of pounds.
Right.
You were correct. I mean, you did hit a goal when you said our goal here is to make fishing better.
Right.
You have not connected this activity at all to making fishing better in your explanation. Neither in, to me anyway, neither in here or in your explanation. In fact, what you're saying is we're stocking fish, but they seem to not be there. Can you connect the dots here? And what I'm asking is up above, on a change item up above, you're reducing expenditures, and on a change item down below, you're adding, and both of them have the same goal, I believe, of making fishing better, but how is this committee to determine which one of those is the correct choice when, to me, neither one of them is, they're saying we're going to quit doing some activity, neither one of them says, well, our fishing satisfaction is going to go from 90% to 93, or to 92 is going, or 88 going the other way. Frankly, that's the goal of fisheries, is to have a good fishing experience. I believe that's the goal.
Madam Chair,
can these be tied to that goal? Numerically measurable? That, I mean, that's really what we're looking for in this new way of doing budgeting.
Okay, and just to add to that as we were going forward, because obviously this is a discussion that needs more time. Your strategic objective is to have healthy and productive fish and wildlife populations maintained on a sustained basis. So something is not right here. And I think we're trying to get at it when we're talking about why are the fish not producing. So I think we need to continue that conversation. Representative Dill.
Thank you, and I just wanted to get this out before, this is on a whole different subject. One of the things that has been a struggle is the, goes back to Director Vadis and then it comes to you, is underwater power lines that our permits are issued for. And by and large, these are generally on lakes that, the permits that are being requested are by and large generally on lakes that have power lines underwater already, because there's usually development on those lakes. And my constituents and other people's constituents have to go through a fair amount of difficulty getting permits for those, including having the commissioners come up and look at the permit site specifically. And it has always come back to that the local fisheries says that they can't, they are the ones that reject the idea of another power line. So my question to you, and I'd like for information provided to our committee, and we don't, to my committee, and we'll share it with this committee, is there any scientific data that suggests that those underwater power lines that are in those lakes are damaging the fishery? And I thought it was interesting that that is the argument, usually, and that the National Park Service, who has to operate under the National Environmental Policy Act, has a power line of about 20 miles running right through the center of a national park that's underwater. And so that's my question, and I'd like to have some information on that. Now, generally speaking, we've resolved these problems, but I just want to know why it constantly has to be such a project to resolve those, and do you have any scientific information? Thank you, Chair, for that latitude.
I think that's a question that can't be answered right now.
No.
And so, and we are running slightly over our time, but I think the questions that need to be asked are on the table. Did you have a final word?
Madam Chair, yes. Just a couple quick points to Mr. Reinhold's question. The walleye stamp appropriation, we're asking access to the dollars to that stamp that the legislature created last year. The reduction that we talked about above is a general fund reduction, so it's very important that as we're talking about these change items, we keep in mind that the change items on the general fund reduction
and the new change items, the new dollars, especially the stamp, because that is dollars that citizens are paying to have us do increased stocking. The other point that's really important, and I'm glad Mr. Reynolds brought it up, is this document cannot stand by itself. It has to be overlaid and compared to our strategic conservation agenda, where the overall outcome related to this is improvement of that fishery satisfaction, the user satisfaction. But to do that, I would have a book like this big for everybody to go through. So that's one of the comments I need to work with you guys on and see how we take that information, work it into here, and create something that does connect all of those dots. So thank you.
And that's why we have hearings. Representative Purcell.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the March 3 minutes for approval.
Representative Purcell has moved the March 3 minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted.